Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Playcock in Bonn. This week, we're departing from our usual format in order to bring you an extended interview with Klára Dobrev, leader of Hungary's Democratic Coalition Party and former vice president of the European Parliament. It's no secret that Donald Trump and Viktor Orban have long been emulating each other. So, what might those wishing to protect American democracy be able to learn from their counterparts in Hungary?
I have heard from my fellow Democrats friends, okay, maybe Trump won the election, but come on, 4 years and then he can never be a president again. But it's not true.
Quite a lot, as it turns out. That's here on Inside Europe.
Hungary, strong country, run by a very powerful, tough leader, tough guy. Press doesn't like him because he's tough. Viktor Orban, Prime Minister of Hungary, very tough man.
Viktor Orban, one of the most respected men. They call him a strong man. He's a tough person.
I also want to pay a very special regard to the leader of Hungary, Viktor Orban, who's a great man and highly respected by everybody. He's done a brilliant job of leading, and he's a very, very special person.
The by now unmistakable voice of the 45th and 47th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump there, musing on the apparently manifold qualities of Hungarian Prime Minister and strong leader Viktor Orban. The admiration of Donald Trump for Viktor Orban and his authoritarian course in Hungary is no secret. And it doesn't just stop at admiration. The architects of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 blueprint for Trump's second presidency openly say that they took Orban's Hungary as their model. Perhaps ironically, however, the success of Orbanesque politics in the USA is happening at a time when Viktor Orban's iron grip on power seems to be slipping. Assembly is a fundamental right, chant demonstrators in Budapest brought out onto the streets in protest against what's being called the Budapest Pride Ban, a law which curtails the right of assembly pertaining to LGBTQ plus events and authorises the use of facial recognition technology to identify event organisers and attendees. Other protests have focused around proposed legislation known as the Transparency Bill, under which organisations or journalists receiving foreign funding would be listed, fined, or even shut down if deemed by the government to be posing a threat to Hungary's sovereignty or culture. Earlier this week, protesters in Budapest launched what organisers described as the beginning of the resistance to Orban. Meanwhile, Orban's main political rival, former Fidesz party insider Peter Madja, has been attracting huge crowds of his own and is consistently polling ahead of Orban in the run-up to national elections, which are due to be held in 2026. So, all in all, a highly interesting time in which to be speaking to the MEP Klára Dobrev, leader of Hungary's Democratic Coalition, former Vice President of the European Parliament, and a veteran of a 15-year struggle to maintain political space in the midst of Viktor Orban's authoritarian turn. Orban's mark is so ubiquitous in Hungarian society that it is often hard to remember what the country was actually like before his election in 2010. Klára Dobrev, however, has not forgotten, as she told me when she sat down for this interview last week.
Before 2010, Hungary was a democracy. We had a lot of debates. We had quarrels. We have made mistakes in government or even in opposition. But you could see that there were checks and balances, there was free media, there was free press, there were demonstrations, even sometimes very big ones. So we looked like a democratic country. And I'm afraid that we leaned back on our imaginable historical armchairs and we took democracy for granted. And we did not felt that how fragile it is. And when Viktor Orban came in 2010, he could destroy our democratic institution within a few years. And one of the explanations was, okay, but Hungary is a new democracy, you know, just after 1990, after the changes, after the fall of communism, maybe we were not mature enough from political sense, our institutions were not mature enough to defend the democracy. But now when I see around, I have the feeling that Orbán was a pilot project, even in democracies like Great Britain, a Brexit could happen. In democracies like the United States, Orbán was a pilot project.
Indeed. And I mean, the US example there is so current. We're talking shortly after Hungary has hosted a CPAC gathering, the friendship between Orbán and President Trump very much on display. American speakers repeatedly referring to Hungary as a model for what President Trump is trying to achieve in the US. What kind of parallels do you see?
The most important parallel, and I'm trying to tell it to my fellow friends, Democrats and moderate Republicans in the United States as well, that in 2010, even among Hungarian Democrats, there was a saying, okay, Orbán can win, even with two-third majority, but then he has 4 years. If he's not delivering, then we just simply will defeat him on elections. And then he destroyed the whole institution, and there are no more free elections in Hungary since 2014 on. And the same happened with the United States. I have heard from my fellow Democrats friends, okay, maybe Trump won the election, but come on, 4 years, and then he can never be a president again. But it's not true. Those illiberals, they are attacking the institutions. They are attacking exactly the checks and balancing, this kind of correction mechanisms within democracy. That's why you have to be very aware. We were not aware enough at that time. And every single time when they attack media, when they attack public administration, when they attack civil organizations, when they attack freedom of speech and so on, just to be able to react on time. Because if it's too late, like it's too late in Hungary, then you have a much bigger trouble.
So, I mean, speaking with the benefit of Hungarian hindsight, you know, what are those key red flags? What are the key signs? And what are the key moments as well, you know, the moments of possibility for organizing, for pushing back?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, even if it will sound a little bit strange, that Orbán has lost the majority of the population's support in 2018. If it would have been democratic election back in 2018 or 22, Orbán would be in opposition right now. Because, and this is very typical for the illiberals, when they come into the power, they just simply do not deliver. Hungary was once before Orbán one of the best countries in Central Eastern Europe, with the highest living standard, with a lot of problems in education, healthcare, but with a developing country. I mean, it was good to live here. Now, all other Eastern European countries just went ahead, from the Baltics, Poland, Slovakia, but even Romania is catching up, Croatia, Slovenia. So now we are one of the poorest ones, because, I mean, democracies, I do understand, sometimes annoying with all these debates and slowness and whatever. But it's the only way how you can secure for a middle long term well-being of people. If there is a mistake, you can correct it. If there is a bad policy, you can correct it within a few years. If there is no democracy, then you can't correct it. In 15 years, we just experienced it on our shoulders. And that's why I'm telling that the performance the Orbán government is doing in healthcare, education, pensions, salaries, and so on, they have lost the majority. But with this artificial and very strange electoral law, which is designed for Fidesz, with using the whole public administration power, every single institution in the government in one party's interest, producing such kind of atmosphere where you are a little bit afraid to talk about opposition, about freedom, about criticism against the government, because you might be fired, or you will, as a small enterprise, you will not get any possibility to live in the country. So with this kind of oppression, he's and with a huge billions of euros spent on propaganda, he's managing always to produce the majority on the election. But now the tension is so big in the country. I mean, people are living in very, very bad circumstances. The amount of poor people is really very high. People are fleeing the country. We don't have migrant problems. We have the problems that everyone is leaving the country. Children are not born It's the lowest fertility rate ever in Hungary. So the tension is very big. I definitely think that in 2026, you can really put a huge pressure and press this government and to organize a big mass protest on the election against the government.
And I mean, one sort of key difference in the present moment is that for the first time in so many years, we have a challenger to Orbán who seems to be consistently polling ahead of him. This is Péter Madja, who is a Fidesz insider, I think it should be said. This is not someone coming from the left. Why is it that the left has not been able to inhabit that space, to be the alternative voice that can bring people together?
First, it's not unprecedented. Before the last election, the 2022, we had the last election. And in 2021, the United Opposition at that time was ahead of Fidesz in all polls. And unfortunately, at that time, actually a right-wing candidate started to talk against the left parties, against the Social Democrats, the oppositional parties. And it destroyed this kind of feeling of being united. I strongly believe that the only way you defeat an illiberal populist is a broad coalition of Democrats, conservatives, liberals, Greens, Social Democrats, socialists. So together, that's the only way. And that's the only way how you can govern a country later on. We don't need the majority of the oppositional voters. We need everyone in order not to get in the same defeat as we went in 2022.
So it's a moment of immense possibility, but also a moment of immense peril. And we're seeing that already. We've had the decision to effectively ban the Budapest Pride March. What is your sort of feeling at the moment regarding this particular moment in Hungarian history? Where are the dangers and where are the possibilities for civil society?
When a politician comes to power in an election, a democratic election, but then there is a moment when he decides not to lose the power and he decides to become an illiberal, to become an autocrat, then this is a one-way road. There is no turning back. That's what we saw with Putin. That's what we see with Lukashenko. That's what we see with Erdogan. And that's what we saw with Orban as well. When you decide that you are building an illiberal state where you are not defeatable, when you take every decision according whether it's helping you to keep in power or not, and not the decisions which are helping the country or not, this is a one-way road, which means there is no turning back. You cannot be a little bit more civilized. There is no consolidation. There is no way an illiberal or an autocrat is now, from now on, I'm going to be a little bit more moderate or more democrat. Every single year, the system is getting worse and worse. And that's what we see now with the ban of Pride, with this law which will pass about frightening all civil organizations or media outlets, and every single year they are more radical and radical, the same way as Putin. This is the Putinization of the country. And this is, again, you ask, where are the red flags? So this is, again, a red flag.
Okay, so red flags abound, and I would really like to come back to the issue of the so-called transparency law later. But just for a minute to stay with this idea of a moment of possibility as well as peril, I suppose my question is, what now? How could civil society respond?
We have 11 months till the election. And in these 11 months, we have to show to the country that every single Democrat is united in order to defeat Orban, and that we need everyone on board. This is always very difficult because politicians and political parties are fighting against each other, are competing against each other. This is democracy. That's what we would like to see in Hungary as well. And now we are forced not to compete, not to fight for our values, for very important values, but to unite.
How does that sort of mission to unite and work together play out in the context of something like defending the Pride March, which is an issue which is divisive along culture war lines, with conservative voters tending to be less happy with the idea of Pride marches than, for example, liberal-based voters?
Well, we can have different values about same-sex marriage. We can have different values about a lot of things. But if you are a Democrat, then you definitely are on the basis that pride cannot be banned, whatever your opinion about this. So when there is a red flag, this is a red flag. Every politician who thinks himself as a Democrat has to be there on the pride. That's why I invited the whole European Parliament. As a member of the European Parliament, I invited all fellow members from different parties that they should come and they should provide and help a little bit to show courage, especially for those people who now are afraid because they have existential threat to participate in a pride. This is exactly the moment when you as a politician have to set an example. This is a point where you have to show that you are united and you are protecting human rights. So these are the points when you can see whether one can overcome his or her political barriers in order to defeat an autocrat or not.
My conversation with the Hungarian MEP Klára Dobrev will continue shortly after the break. That's here with me, Kate Laycock, on Inside Europe. Last week, the Hungarian government made a surprising concession, postponing a parliamentary vote on a controversial piece of legislation called the Transparency in Public Life Bill until after the summer recess. The bill, which would enable the government to fine and potentially ban NGOs, media outlets and journalists which it deems to be receiving foreign money and acting against the national interest, has been heavily criticised by rights groups. Now, as regular listeners to Inside Europe may be aware, our own Budapest correspondent, Stefan Boss, has been on a Hungarian media blacklist for some time. So I asked Hungarian MEP Klára Dobrev what was new about this new law. How could it make things worse?
Very simple, because it's not only freezing the funds, it's threatening the journalists or the owners or representative or managers of the media outlet with their own personal income and wealth to have a fine which is 25 times the funding they receive. So it's a personal threat. It's not a political threat. And you see, in the 21st century, you don't have to put people in jail because with this all propaganda and media set up, you can silence them very easily. For example, let me tell you an example. The Pride was one of, from an atmosphere point of view, it was really a march of joy and smile. And it was sponsored by a lot of multinational companies, all the big companies who were in Hungary, it was sponsored by them. And this law came out and all sponsors disappeared. Okay, not all of them, but majority of them. So you can just simply create an atmosphere where this kind of solidarity within the society is not working anymore. And the same with the journalists and media outlets, the topics you are not allowed to talk about is, for example, the topics of foreign policy of the government. So you are not allowed to criticize the way how Orbán is a puppet of Putin and supporting the Russian aggression against Ukraine. You are not supposed to criticize the role of the churches, which are really like political actors within the country. You are not allowed to criticize the way how Orbán speaks about Europe and the European Union and so on. So those kind of left, progressive, liberal values, which are important, you are not supposed to write about them. And you can see small journals and small newsletters who stopped to publish any political articles. So when the autocracy goes into your soul, into your mind, you don't need external censors when the censorship is already put into your head and you are afraid of it. So I think the most dangerous attack is not the concrete penalty, the concrete fine. The biggest damage they cause is to the mindset and the soul of people. And that's why it's a red flag for everyone.
Finally, Clara Dobrev, I really wanted to talk to you with your Brussels hat on, because listeners can't see this, but Clara Dobrev has just mimed putting a hat on. It is a substantial hat, though, isn't it? Because you are a former vice president of the European Parliament, currently a sitting MEP within the Progressive Alliance of Socialists and Democrats bloc. And from Brussels, of course, you've seen how some, what is it, 18 billion euros worth of funds has been withheld from Hungary over rule of law concerns. And yet, the democratic backsliding has continued. So has the EU got it wrong? I mean, what would an effective approach towards Orbán look like? And I'm not just thinking about disapproving noises here, but, you know, really concrete measures.
Even after 15 years of Orbán rule, Hungarians are pro-European. So if you ask them whether do they want to quit EU or not, the majority, even the Fidesz voters, the Orbán voters, would say, no, we are European. It's over 1,000 years of Hungarian history that we always wanted to be part of Europe, and always someone dragged us out, whether it was the Tatars, the Turkish, or the Habsburgs pushed us back, or the Russians later. And so it's so deep in Hungarian history that we are Europe. We always want to be Europeans. So what I really think is that when you put the question black and white, and sometimes you have to put questions black and white, if you put the question in Hungary black and white, Orbán or Europe, then a majority of the people would choose Europe. But for that, you have to show what Europe means. Every single time when the European institutions, mainly the Commission and the Council, wanted to make some kind of compromise with Orbán, then this just strengthened the feeling that, okay, Europe is not with us. Europe is with the Orbán government. It's so painful to say for me, but Orbán could have never built his illiberal regime without the European funding, which was coming to the country for 10 years without proper control. All his oligarchs, friends, son-in-law, father, and what they built up, their wealth is bigger than the royal family's wealth in Great Britain. So in 10 years, it was stolen from European taxpayers, and it was stolen mainly from Hungarian people, and it was converted to their own wealth. And with this wealth, they bought the media outlets, they bought the critical companies in energy, in telecommunication, in banking sector, in land in the country. So this uncontrolled flow of money enabled Orbán to build his illiberal regime. And it's a very important sign for every single penny which will come from Europe to any other countries, that it has to have a control. That's why we are saying that until this control is not built in, the money should remain in Brussels. It's there, it's for Hungary, but it cannot go anymore to Orbán's family and Orbán's oligarchs. And I think Brussels should show much stronger what does Europe mean. It should make interim measures because of the pride. It should make interim measures because of this new legislation banning civil organizations and journalists from writing freely. So it should really show that Europe is a union of values and democracy and not simply a bunch of countries.
Clara Dobrev is a Hungarian MEP and leader of Hungary's Democratic Coalition Party. She was vice president of the European Parliament between July 2019 and January 2022. If you have any comments about that interview or ideas for future guests that you'd like to hear interviewed on the show, then do drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
The ocean is vast, beautiful, and lawless. I'm Ian Urbina, back with an all-new season of The Outlaw Ocean. The stories we bring you this season are literally life or death. We look into the shocking prevalence of forced labor, mind-boggling overfishing, migrants hunted and captured. The Outlaw Ocean takes you where others won't. Available on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, a narrative podcast series that explores why teachers are leaving education and what can be done to stop the exodus. This season, we're getting a look at the year and the life of teachers from across the country through their audio journals.
I am Darcy Ostermiller.
This is Megan Obergoff.
This is Sophie V.
This is Charlie Blackwood.
This is Taylor Barron.
This is Iva Moss Ridman.
This is David Whisker.
This is Dan Morris.
This is Amanda Smith.
Look for Those Who Can't Teach Anymore, Season 2, a different kind of the same thing.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn, and over on the other side of the studio glass, I can see two colleagues, Sam Baker and Charlie Shield. Come on in, guys. Come on in. So Charlie Shield and Sam Baker may be familiar names to listeners. They're just entering the studio now. That is because I have got into the habit of pinching you guys for production purposes. But really, I've been taking you away from more glamorous jobs elsewhere, which is why I want you in the studio. Welcome.
Hello. Hello.
Hello. You are the brains and the voices behind Living Planet's Cost of Climate series, and I'm a big fan, so I wanted to sort of get you both in the studio to talk about it. What gave you the idea?
Well, Charlie and I have both been reporting on climate change for 7 years now, almost 7 years, or seven
Six
in
years.
Case.
Years.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
A few, quite a few now. And there's so many interesting angles with climate change, political, personal, but one I felt like we hadn't gotten into very much specifically was the economics behind climate change. How much is this costing us already, and how much is it going to cost us in the future? And we realized that's actually quite a big thing to cover.
Mm, yeah. We still find that we have this kind of disconnect between the issue of climate change, which still seems for many people quite abstract, and then, you know, these bread and butter issues for people like cost of living, inflation, tariffs, thanks, Donald, and rising prices. And we wanted to make the link between the two a bit clearer. And there's a lot more work to be done in that regard.
Right. And it's so important, right? Because one of the main arguments that you hear when it comes to anything from climate mitigation to adaptation, or, you know, anything sort of green and to do with rethinking the way in which we run our economies, that you are always going to hear, oh, but it will cost too much.
Yeah.
And you've been crunching the numbers.
We have. Yeah, I mean, that's true. And that's what we say throughout the series, that it is going to take investment and it is going to cost money. But the alternative is far more expensive, like not even to mention the existential issue of climate change, but it's very expensive. And it's linked to a lot of the reasons that prices are rising for people today.
Right. And this isn't just sort of coming from, you know, an ideological, hardcore, left-wing, eco perspective. I mean, you've got insurance companies on your side as well, right?
Yeah. And you see that, you know, these bills that people pay, you know, on a regular basis, that they're seeing creep up. And some of them, like insurance, have made their way into the news recently. But there's some things that are a little bit less obvious, whether that's, you know, a crop that was affected by drought, getting more expensive in the groceries you buy in the grocery store. So there's just so many aspects to this that come into our lives in maybe not such clear ways, but affect, you know, our bills at the end of the month.
So I have to say, I'm a paid up fan of this series. And one of the things that I really loved about it was that you do go into the numbers. I'm not someone who is very good at conceptualizing anything to do with anything that has figures in, basically. And yet I felt that you guys were crunching the numbers for me in a really transparent way that enabled me to feel that I was with you at every step of the process and that I trusted you. And like, that's so important in this kind of journalism, right?
I think while making the series, Charlie and I both wish we had an economics degree at one point or another. So I have to say it was also us really having to get our heads all the way around these things and understand them inside and out to be able to deliver them in a way that we could understand and therefore others could also understand.
Of the two of you, and I realize that this may have been a sort of slight narrative device, but it would be Charlie that I would have tipped to have had an economics degree.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I'm less of a numbers gal than Sam is.
So I wanted to talk as well about intangible cost, because yes, you are very good at breaking down the figures, but you also examine the human cost, the emotional cost, the cost to wildlife. And actually, and this isn't a European example, but, you know, Charlie, you did quite a bit of recording in Australia, where you're from. And one of the absolute images of devastation and grief that stuck with me had to do with kangaroos.
Yes, exactly. So cost has this great double meaning that we wanted to utilize in the series. We really wanted to look into the literal financial costs of things, but then also the bigger picture, the intangible costs, as you refer to them, these more invisible costs of what rising temperatures are doing to our planet.
There was no vegetable matter apart from leaves falling out of the trees on the land. No vegetable matter at all. It was all gone. It was dead. It was dead as animals, kangaroos, had walked on it. It turned to powder. And we had quite a bit of grass, but the grass was actually cooked. And you could see the kangaroo would hop across the grass. And every time they landed, the dust would fly up. And then you could stand back and look through the grass and you could see everywhere where the kangaroo had landed, there was bare dirt. Because the grass had actually completely disintegrated, had fractured into powder. So our ecosystem, it didn't decline, it just collapsed.
After months of relentless heat and drought came a raging hailstorm in a neighbouring region that sent freezing winds across Brent's property.
It was so cold, they died of hypothermia. And under all these trees, there were just dead kangaroos everywhere. The kangaroos were poor because of the drought, but they were still alive. It killed, 7,000 kangaroos. I've never seen it happen in this region. And my father, who's 94, he'd never seen it happen before, and he's been on this property all his life. It was a mass die-off, driven by climate change.
So, I mean, Charlie, I was actually really interested by the Australian examples because I was actually very conscious that in terms of my emotional, visceral reaction to images of climate destruction, a lot of them have actually been Australian. And that was to do with the effect on wildlife. You know, those images of charred koalas coming out of the burnt remnants of forests after the big wildfires a while back. You know, like it's been very mediatized. But then at the same time, you know, you guys are reporting in a European context. And here, although there have been big disasters, and we've actually got an example coming up, there are still, I think, lots of people who are still able to go about their daily lives with the knowledge of climate change as a background hum, but, you know, not really with any firsthand visceral experience of climate change induced loss yet. Right. So I guess my question, and it is a long one, is about how do you as journalists go about communicating in this context where you're going to have an audience with such varied experience of the proximity of climate loss?
Well, that's interesting that you say that. And I think that points to how we've seen climate change in the media. And certainly we have those images from Australia, other places that have experienced wildfires or, you know, big storms like hurricanes. But actually, Europe's the fastest heating continent. So things are changing here faster than any other continent. Unfortunately, I think the ways in which those are affecting people are not as easily visualized, so we don't see them on the news. But in one of the episodes in this series, we dig into heat and how it's this kind of silent killer that we don't talk about so much. But there have been, between 2000 and 2019, so almost two decades, there were nearly 500,000 people around the world who died from heat-related causes. Over a third of those were in Europe, half were in Asia, but a huge number in Europe. And part of this has to do with Europe just not being ready for these changes that are happening so quickly here. Our buildings not being built for heat, our public health infrastructure not warning people what to do about it. And so we've seen this in huge numbers of deaths during heat waves, particularly of older and vulnerable people. And I think that's something that doesn't get put in the news because it's someone, you know, passing away in their home. It's something that isn't kind of easily visualized, but it's having a huge effect on people and families across the continent.
Mm. Perhaps this also has something to do with the fact that, as Sophie Sue Amgassen, the ecological economist that I spoke to in episode 5 of the miniseries, said, that through the process of industrialization, Europe destroyed a lot of its biodiversity and nature that places in the global south, places in Australia, still have. So when we see those being destroyed, it looks a little different, I think, than the effects that we're experiencing here in Europe. Maybe it is a little bit more invisible.
Mm, that's really interesting. I love that ecological economist, which is kind of a clue, isn't it, that we're going to have to rethink the way that we think about the economy as well. Mm. Yeah, we have an alternative economy special coming up next week. So. Little plug there. But just sort of sticking with that train of thought, there is also an immense sort of opportunity here as well, which you do dig into as well, that, you know, in because we have to adapt to a changing planet, we can do things differently, perhaps even better.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Favorite examples?
Well, clean energy. Like down the line, clean energy, you know, it's not just going to make the air that we breathe cleaner and safer, but it's going to save us money. It's not as expensive as our current fossil fuel based energy system. So that's one of the best solutions that we've got already. We just need to implement it.
Mm. Yeah, and that's really getting to the heart of what's driving climate change. On the flip side of that, we know that a certain amount of climate change is baked in. We've already passed that 1.5 degree threshold. And while we work to get temperatures back down kind of in the longer term, we are going to have to deal with what's here already. But by building these kind of more resilient homes and cities, actually it ends up saving us so much more money if we just build them in the first place or upgrade them or do these things that aren't as big as they're kind of made out to be often by politicians. You know, it can be as simple as some better windows to deal with hurricanes or whatever it is, depending on where you live. But actually, there's a lot that can be done that will make us safer and more comfortable and protect us for a long time down the road.
And save us money.
There we are. There's the pitch. Living Planet's Cost of Climate Change series is out now wherever you get your podcasts. And there will be a bonus episode dropping soon. Charlie Shield, Sam Baker, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, not to be outdone, we at Inside Europe have gone on and commissioned our very own cost of climate change story. The region that immediately came to mind was Valencia in Spain. You might remember the images from last autumn, walls of water moving through the town, taking roads, buildings, seemingly everything with them. Now, in the space of just 24 hours, the region received more rainfall than the average amount usually spread out over the course of a whole year. 228 people lost their lives and over 600,000 businesses were destroyed or affected. The Spanish government, as well as the European Union, promised billions would be spent on fixing infrastructure and helping people to rebuild their lives. But the road to recovery is slow as well as costly, as Ashish Sharma has been finding out.
I'm here in Paiporta, which is known as Ground Zero. Over 6 months ago, when the Dana occurred, this town was a no-go zone. It was flooded, and when the water subsided, residents were left with thick brown mud, in some places knee-deep, to clean up. Paiporta took the brunt of the damage, so much so that it wasn't until April before traffic lights were functioning again in this area.
This is the main square here in Paiporta, and all this playground to the kids, it was destroyed. You can see this is all reconstructed.
Marta Chico has lived her entire life here. Her house was ruined after it was flooded, water climbing up to 2 meters inside the house, destroying everything.
You couldn't walk right there. We are walking now because these things,
the drains,
they were open and they were with stocks to not fall into them.
We can still see there are houses like that one over there that's not got windows and it looks like it's just been recently redone and they're still doing a lot of work.
These houses in the ground floor, they are empty. You can't live there. They are super cold. They haven't got furnitures. The walls are with humidity.
Humidity. But the problems lie deeper than infrastructure and buildings. 6 months after the Dana, and still 30% of businesses that were affected are unable to restart. Marta's uncle is one example. He's a skilled artisan who specializes in making saddles and decorative uniforms for horses. His policy scheme meant he didn't qualify for a full compensation for the damage done to his workshop. Marta donated some of the money from her insurance claim to repair a house to help her uncle, and has also turned to crowdfunding.
We have our crowdfunding to help my uncle, but there are lots of them here in Paiporta. There are some cases of people that haven't got enough money because they are not going to receive any help for the government or for the insurance, or they couldn't pay insurance or whatever. So there are lots of initiatives like this in crowdfunding where people donating a little bit, they can help so much.
Well, I'm still in Paiporta and I've just arrived at the doors of Mama Pato, which is a nursery school, or should I say was a nursery school. It's been in existence for 30 years, but the damage caused by the flooding last year has pretty much devastated the school. I've got Maria Castells and Chara, her sister. You're both the dueños, the owners of the school. Charlotte, I can see that there is still so much of a mess here. The walls are completely destroyed. You have no lighting, no electricity. There are workers here. But this is now 6 months after it all happened. Why is it taking so long?
We haven't received any kind of help because the insurance consortium didn't give us an assessor until March 19th. By then, we were at the stage where we decided that even though we didn't have any help, we were going to rebuild the school.
The government has said that there are billions of euros that they will give to help businesses. Why are you not able to have access to that money?
Porque no los han dado.
Well, because they just haven't given it to us. The only help we have received so far from the central government of Spain is 10,000 euros, and from the local government, 15,000. That is all we've received.
But help has been on hand from other sources.
I'm Marta Nogueras. I'm the general manager of Lanzadera. Lanzadera is a startup accelerator promoted by Juan Roche. It's the president and the owner of Mercadona. It's the biggest supermarket chain in Spain. He offers a financial aid that was 35 million euros.
This is his personal money, right?
100% personal, that came from Juan Roche, and it was a grant. The mission of this aid was to help this business in order to reopen as soon as possible. The initiative is addressed to small companies, also startups or maybe self-employed workers who have suffered material damage. The donation that we are going to bring this to these companies, it's going to boost for the business to reopen as quickly as possible.
While a lot of repair work has been carried out, such was the damage that it's still nowhere near enough for people to resume a normal life. As the government and insurance companies slowly plough through the claims being made, it is hoped that those in need of help will soon find that their dark, broody clouds of the last 6 months will have a silver lining. Ashish Sharma, DW, Valencia.
And the cost of climate change is also the topic of this week's quiz.
That's right. This week, I am outsourcing our poll to Charlie and Sam. So head on over to Spotify and expect an environmentally themed question. Congratulations to everyone last week, by the way, who knew that it was indeed the Netherlands who were the world's first ever country to legalize same-sex marriage. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Thank you.
finally this week, another recovery story, but one which is not climate change related. 2 years ago, twin earthquakes devastated southern Turkey and northern Syria. In Turkey alone, the death toll was over 53,000 people spread out over 11 provinces. Turkey's southernmost province, Hatay, was the hardest hit. And whilst reconstruction is underway, hundreds of thousands of people are still living in sprawling container camps, whilst others prepare to move into newly built tower blocks. And what about the less tangible damage, the loss of cultural heritage and social traditions in a region known for its rich multicultural past and lively blend of Turkish, Arab and Christian influences? Yelena Gostoli has been finding out.
Construction sites and the relentless noise that comes with them are everywhere in southern Turkey, a region still bearing deep scars from the earthquakes 2 years ago. The largest reconstruction project is taking shape near Adıyaman, set to house up to 65,000 people when completed. Rows upon rows of identical seven-story buildings stretch into the horizon, standing empty on a hilltop outside the city. In Kahramanmaraş, an identical-looking social housing development project rises near the city centre. Two massive banners hang prominently, featuring the portraits of Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, alongside Azerbaijan's leader İlham Aliyev, his close ally and a key sponsor of the project. These developments are part of the government's promise to rebuild the region within 2 years, with a target of 680,000 housing units. Erdogan said recently that 45% have been completed. But for more than 600,000 people, home is still a metal box in one of the many container cities scattered across the landscape. On February 6th, at the exact time the first earthquake struck in the early hours of the morning, thousands break the silence. Can anyone hear my voice? They chant, echoing the cries of those who remained buried under the rubble for days. More than 23,000 people died in the province of Hatay alone. Few have been held accountable. But in one place, the historic heart of Antakya, the cobbled streets remain lined with the ruins of stone houses, their walls crumbled in on themselves. This is the heart of ancient Antioch, founded in 3000 BC, a city of Roman and Byzantine mosaics, mosques, churches, and historic stone homes. As the sweet, tangy scent of church candles fills the air, Christians and Muslims pray side by side in Arabic and Turkish, in a city that has long prided itself on its diversity, where faiths, languages and cultures have coexisted for centuries. While most of the population is either Sunni or Alawite, the city is also home to minority groups, including Arabic-speaking Antiochian Greeks, as well as Syriac Orthodox and Catholic communities. According to the population office, at least 100,000 people have left Antakya, out of a population of 400,000 before the earthquake, though the actual number is slightly higher. Now, many fear that this diversity and its heritage could be lost. Father Francis, originally from Bangalore, India, he has lived in Turkey for nearly 20 years and is one of the Antakyans working to preserve what remains of the city's rich cultural heritage. His church stands tucked away amid the ruins of Kurtuluş Street, once the world's first illuminated street, now swallowed by darkness. The earthquake left it badly damaged, but thanks to support from the Catholic Capuchin Association, the church has been reinforced and partially restored. A fragile beacon of resilience in a place still mired in uncertainty over reconstruction.
The church is a starting point, actually. No, that was my point. My presence and presence of the church is something which will unite the people, will bring them back, you know. So that's what we started, and it's slowly paying off. You know, people are coming back.
Turkey's post-earthquake damage assessment report identifies more than 8,000 historical buildings and heritage sites across the 11 affected regions. Along Curtulu Street, banners marked Ministry of Culture and Tourism now drape over damaged historical buildings, signalling efforts to preserve what remains. Debbie Benjar Mosque, whose dome and minaret collapsed, is one of 82 historical buildings in Antakya undergoing restoration, led by the Directorate General of Foundations. Adam Boskurt, the organization's regional director in Hatay, hopes the mosque, which was last destroyed in another earthquake in 1853 and rebuilt in the Ottoman period, will reopen in July.
The special thing about our Habib-i-Necker Mosque is that it is the first mosque established in Anatolia. It has been destroyed 8 times.
The Catholic Church of St. Peter's and St. Paul's, led by Father Francis, is one of the few buildings that was spared by the earthquake. In the immediate aftermath, it became a shelter for survivors. Today, 4 families continue to live here despite the destruction around it. The church community, once numbering around 100, has shrunk to just 20 members. Among them is 60-year-old Isa Jarjar.
Many people either lost their lives or their property. I lost 2 of my relatives, my father and my sister. Our houses were destroyed. We stand up again and try to hold on to life, like everyone living in Antakya. This is not easy. It is very difficult to start from scratch.
On April 5, 2023, Antakya's historic center was declared a risky area by a presidential decree. Many homeowners in the area remain in limbo, unable to secure permits to restore their historic properties. Meanwhile, some locals have criticized the government's redevelopment plans, saying they were excluded from the decision-making process. They fear the project will force them out and transform the neighborhood into a commercial and tourist center, stripping it of its original character and community life. According to Hatay's governor, Mustafa Masatli, rebuilding historical areas requires additional planning and approvals.
The restoration of historical sites tends to take longer because a separate project must be prepared for their preservation, along with obtaining institutional approval. As a result, historical structures may be completed later than modern ones. God willing, by 2026, the restoration will be completed.
But for now, at least here, history lies in rubble and the community has mostly moved away in search of work or better living conditions. Isa Jarjar, who lost his job as a mechanic after the earthquake, still considers his family one of the lucky few and hopes others who have left will soon be able to return.
In this whole neighborhood, there is only us, a neighbor, and our fathers. We live alone. Thanks to our fathers, we attend evening prayers and weekend services. This helps us stay stronger in spirit.
Ilenia Gostoli, DW, in southern Turkey.
And it is with that challenge that we reach the end of the show. Inside Europe was produced by Sam Baker and me, Kate Laycock, with special thanks to Charlie Shield. Our sound engineer was Ziad Abu Sleiman. The address for feedback and ideas for future shows is insideeurope@dw.com. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.